Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, which I will entitle A Time for Everything. The book of Ecclesiastes, of course, was written by Solomon. We start now in verses 1 through 8. Solomon says, "There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace." In other words, there's a time for everything. Now, of course, when we read those verses, we think of the famous Birds song back in the 1960s, that folk group, BYRDS. I think David Crosby of Crosby, Stills, and Nash was in that group. I can't remember exactly. Roger Gwynn, I think his name was. Anyways, a beautiful song. And, of course, almost everybody has that song in their head when they read this passage of Scripture. In fact, many people don't even realize it came from Solomon when the Birds are playing that song on the internet or on the radio. I doubt very many people have taken the time to understand exactly what Solomon was getting at. Well, basically, he summarizes what he's going to say in these first eight verses. In verse 1, there is an appointed time for everything. Here's what Adam Clark says about that. God, by his providence, governs the world and has determined particular things and operations to particular times. In those times, such things may be done with propriety and success. But if we neglect the appointed seasons, we sin against this providence and become the authors of our own distresses. So basically what Solomon is saying in verses 1 through 8 is that everything is changing as we go through time, but God has it all under control. Now in verse 3, Solomon says there's a time to kill and a time to heal. That killing there is not homicide, or I should say not murder. Solomon is talking about killing in a just war or in self-defense. There's never a proper time to murder, ever. That's a terrible crime, and that's not what Solomon was saying. Time to tear down and a time to build up at the end of verse 3. Well, sometimes you have to tear down the old building before you put the new building up. Verse 4, time to weep and a time to laugh. In the vicissitudes of life, there are some sad things that happen. It's all right to cry. And then sometimes good things happen. And then sometimes good things happen, and then it's all right to laugh. Time to mourn and a time to dance says the same thing. Verse 5, Solomon says there's a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. Now, why would you throw stones? It's not throwing stones at people. That's not justified. It's talking about throwing stones out of a field or a vineyard. The stones are in the field or in the vineyard in the way of crops and in the way of growing fruit, and so you clear the field and throw them out. And then as you throw them out, you gather those stones and you make houses and fences and walls. At the end of verse 5, Solomon says there's a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. Sometimes you make alliances and friendships with people, and sometimes you just don't do that. And by the way, that's a good antidote to people like me, unfortunately, who have or have had an idea of promiscuous love. You got to love everybody. No, you don't. I mean, we're supposed to love people and then that we want the best for them. Even Adolf Hitler, we wish he had gotten saved before he got killed. But I'm talking about embracing people in friendships or alliances or marriages. There's a lot of people you ought not to marry. There is a time to shun embracing. And there's a lot of people that you ought not to go into business with as a business partner. And there's a lot of people you ought not to go into ministry with. Paul himself did not go into ministry with John Mark, because he didn't like the way John Mark was operating at first. In verse 6, Solomon says, there's a time to search and a time to give up as lost. I think of my glasses, which are now lost, my first pair. I know they're in the house somewhere. I've searched for them. I've given up temporarily. I haven't given them up as lost yet, but at some point I might have to. That's just the way life is. A time to keep and a time to throw away. I had a water pick that just blew up, had it since high school, over 50 years, half a century with one water pick. My wife used it every night, and then it blew up. The cable, the tube, broke, sprayed water everywhere, and she ditched my water pick. It's time to throw it away. Things happen in this life. Things get old. And, of course, there are some things you keep, such as memories, pictures, and photographs. Verse 7, a time to tear apart, a time to sew together. Sometimes your clothes get old. You just have to rip them up and use them as rags. But sometimes you can take cloth and sew together and make something new. A time to be silent at the end of verse 7, and a time to speak. And, of course, the times that you should be silent are probably more. Those appropriate times to be silent are probably more than the appropriate times to speak. But sometimes you need to speak. You need to speak up. Sometimes by your silence, you might be condoning evil. And verse 8, there's a time to love and a time to hate. Now, this is a problem. Why is it allowed to hate? Well, that doesn't mean to hate personally. John Gill says hate means to love less, as to love a friend less when he proves treacherous and unfaithful. That word hate is really slippery in translation. Remember, Jesus said, unless you hate your mother and a father, you can't be my disciple. It doesn't mean that you hate them. It means you love them less than being a disciple of Christ. Another way you can handle that seemingly difficult problem is by saying that hating here means to pass justice on them, either militarily or judicially. And I think the last part of verse 8 helps confirm that interpretation, because Solomon says there's a time for war and a time for peace. Well, of course, you hate in the sense of beating your enemies. It doesn't mean you hate them personally. I remember reading about old Civil War veterans from the North and the South. They constantly had these meetings together after the war and would share their memories of the war. They didn't hate each other. They didn't hate each other at all. But they were shooting to kill each other. So I think that's how we need to take hate there. But at any rate, Solomon here in these first 8 verses contrasts things that are what he calls under the sun. That means things that are in this life. And he says there are certain ways that things need to happen or to be done in this life under the sun. But in the back of Solomon's mind, there's always the idea of subspecie aeternitatis, which is a fancy Latin phrase that means under the aspect of eternity. I love that phrase. It's used all the time in intellectual discourse, because for some reason in the mind of man, we tend to want to think about eternity. And in fact, in verse 11 in Ecclesiastes 3, we're going to see that God put eternity in our hearts. And so Solomon, as we go through Ecclesiastes, he constantly contrasts life under the sun in this life and the way things ought to be in the next life. We go now to Ecclesiastes 3, verses 9 through 11. Solomon continues, what profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. Now here we have that contrast. First of all, Solomon says, I see what men are doing in this life, the task which God has given the sons of men. I see that, and that's appropriate. In verse 11, Solomon says, God has made everything appropriate in its time. In other words, in this life, it's appropriate to be working. But in contrast to that, God has also set eternity in men's hearts, which is the opposite of this life. And men in eternity will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end, because man's going to die. He's not going to find out in the way that he finds out things in this life, because sooner or later he's going to die, and his task will be meaningless, futile, and striving after the wind. So it seems in verse 9 that Solomon is saying something which contrasts with verse 10, that contradicts it, actually. In verse 9, he says, what profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? It's all vanity. It's no good. But then in verse 10, he says, I've seen the task that men do. And verse 11, he says, it's appropriate. So it seems like there's a contrast there. How can something that's vain and futile be appropriate? It's because it depends on how you look at it. If you're looking at it as only in this life, well, sure, it's appropriate. But if you look at it subspecie aeternitatis, from the aspect of eternity, it's vain, futile, and meaningless. Let's look at some of Solomon's other observations about the lack of profit of labor. Ecclesiastes 1 verse 3, Solomon says, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Rhetorical question, Solomon saying, there is no advantage that man has in all his work which he does under the sun. Ecclesiastes 2:11. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. Basically what Solomon was saying, I can't take it with me when I go. Here's what Adam Clark says about this. Love of money, the basest of all passions, and restless ambition drive men to many labors and expedients, which perplex and often destroy them. He, then, who lives without God, travails in pain all his days. I'm emphasizing there, who lives without God, it's all vain. But now if you are doing what God has given you, in verse 10, I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men, well, that's different. That's appropriate, because God will tell you that what you're working for is only appropriate for this life. But God has also set eternity in your heart, and there's certain things that are appropriate to the next life. Here's what John Gill says about this. Man has no profit of his labor, since his time is so short to enjoy it, and he leaves it to another. He knows not who, and while he lives, is attended with continual vicissitudes and changes. Sometimes it is a time for one thing, and sometimes for its contrary, so that there is nothing certain and to be depended on, and a man can promise himself nothing in this world pleasant or profitable to him, and much less that will be of any advantage to him hereafter. And so I guess I need to reemphasize again, verses 1 through 8, there's a time for this and a time for that. That is designed to show the transitory nature of life. Things change. Nothing's permanent. Everything changes. The friends I had when I was young, my high school's gone. I don't care about my college anymore. Almost every church I join eventually dies. I told that to a fellow believer at a meeting. I didn't know him very well, and he looked at me like I was to be most pitied. I thought to myself, don't feel sorry for me. That's the way it is. That's what happens in this life. Things change. But God does not change. We want things to be permanent, but they're not. In verse 11, Solomon says, God has made everything appropriate in its time, again, for those who love him, and again, under the sun. And that, of course, calls to mind Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for the good of those who love God, those who are called according to his purpose. That is what makes everything make sense in all the transitory happenings of this life. God has made everything appropriate because he works all things together for our good. Here's what John Gill says about that. All things in creation are made by him for his pleasure and glory, and all well and wisely. There is a beauty in them all. So all things in providence. He upholds all things. He governs and orders all things according to the counsel of his will. Some things are done immediately by him, others by instruments, and some are only permitted by him. Some he does himself, some he wills to be done by others, and some he suffers to be done. But in all there is a beauty and harmony, and all are ordered, disposed, and overruled to answer the wisest and greatest purposes. Everything is done in the time in which he wills it shall be done, and done in the time most fit and suitable for it to be done. And that is a very fancy explanation of how God has made everything appropriate in its time in verse 11. Actually, verse 11 is a good summary for the first 8 verses. There's a time for this and a time for that. There's a time for everything. He's made everything appropriate in its time, he says at the end of verse 11. Adam Clark says, the most finished works of art are bungling jobs when compared with the meanest operation of nature. Nature fits together just perfectly. Let's look at that phrase, in its time. Everything is appropriate in its time, verse 11. Labor is vanity unless it is appreciated for its value in its time. There's a time for labor. That's during our earthly existence. If we look at labor as something God-given for this life, that is not vain striving after the wind. But if we try to find ultimate meaning from our labor for eternity, oh yes, that's vain striving after the wind. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about everything is appropriate in its time, or labor is appropriate in its time. Quote, earthly pursuits, while lawful in their season, are unprofitable when made by man what God never intended them to be, the chief good. Solomon had tried to create an artificial forced joy at times when he ought rather to have been serious. The result, therefore, of his labor to be happy out of God's order was disappointment. A time to plant refers to his planting, a time to laugh, to his mirth, laughter, build up, gather stones, to his building, embrace, love, to his princess, to get, to gather, all that activity All of these were of no profit, because not in God's time and order of bestowing happiness was it. This idea of everything under the sun is appropriate in its time, everything is appropriate in its time, reminds us of Psalms chapter 1, verse 3. The unknown author of this psalm says, "He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season." A tree will grow its fruit in its season. Your job will produce fruit in its season. After a long period of maternity, maybe your ministry, the same thing. You work and you work and you work and you don't see anything, but in due season, at the appropriate time, God will allow the fruit to come forth. And its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. Now let's go to this phrase, "He has put eternity in our hearts," in verse 11. The KJV has, "He has put the world in our hearts." I don't have any idea what that's supposed to mean. Modern translations have, "He has put eternity in our hearts." Now, I'm going to give you three options as to what eternity means here. Option number one, eternity is a sinful love of the world. That's if you take the KJV translation. God put a sinful love of the world in our hearts. Man desires to find eternity in the world, with the result that he cannot find out God's eternal purpose from beginning to end because he's focusing on this world. No, that's not what it means. Why would God put something like that in someone's heart? Why would God put a sinful desire to love the world in somebody's heart? So that's not correct, I don't believe. Option number two, eternity that's been put in a man's heart is a desire to live a long time in this world. Now, there's a little problem with that, because if you desire to live a long time in this world, you might say, well, that's sinful. I don't know why that's sinful. I can see why God would make man to want to live forever. Most every human being wants to live forever. People are freezing their bodies in cryogenic companies to try to get resurrected when the technology is around to resurrect them from the dead. It seems to me that it's a natural desire. God made us to be eternal. So I have no problem with that. And of course, that natural desire has been perverted because of sin, but I have no problem with the idea that God put eternity in our hearts as being the desire to live forever. I've got no problem with that, but I don't think that's what it means. I think option C is correct. Option C, nature reveals to men that there is something much greater than this present life. He has put eternity in our hearts. In other words, every human being wonders about the afterlife. And of course, he doesn't know what the afterlife is. The last part of verse 11 says, after eternity has been put in the man's heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. You're not going to find out about eternity, but you want to know. Now, you look in Wikipedia. I did this one time. How many people believe in an afterlife? The percentages are incredibly high. Now, most people think, well, I'll just die and go to heaven. I don't need to have redemption and atonement for my sins because God loves everybody. But most people believe in an afterlife. Atheists, a lot of times, do not, because they're materialist and the afterlife would involve a non-material existence. But atheists are a small minority of the human race. Most everybody believes in an afterlife. So yes, God has put eternity in our hearts, and I think that's what Solomon meant there. This reminds us of Romans 1, verses 19 through 20. Paul says, "Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through that which has been made, so that they are without excuse." In other words, you look around, you look at the stars, and you think, something bigger than me out there, and it's probably eternal. Now, at the end of verse 11, Solomon says, "Man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end." The implication maybe there is you're going to have to wait until you die, until you enter into your eternal life so that you can find out what God has done. You're not going to do it in this life. The fact that we cannot find out what eternity betokens, we can't find out what eternity is like in this life, is reflected in Romans 11:33. Paul says, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and untraceable his ways." We go now to Ecclesiastes 3, verses 12 through 14. Solomon continues, "I know that there's nothing better for them." Now, who is the them? That's the workers mentioned in verse 9. Let me go back and read verse 9. "What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils?" We drop down to verse 12. "I know that there is nothing better for them," for these workers, "than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it, for God has so worked that men should fear them. Now again, in verse 12, it sounds contradictory. Solomon keeps saying that labor is vain, futile, striving after the wind, but then he says in verse 12, hey, rejoice, do good. Verse 13, every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. Isn't that a contradiction? Well, no, because looked at from the aspect of being under the sun in this life, yes, labor is good. God made Adam and Eve to work in the garden. It was part of his plan. God didn't have the attitude of toward work as Maynard G. Krebs and the old Dobie Gillis show had. He would sit there whenever he was asked to work in the store there in Dobie Gillis' store. Maynard G. Krebs would say, work! He didn't like it. He was a beatnik. But that's not God's attitude toward work. Work is good, but not if you invest all of your hopes and dreams in your labor. You will be disappointed because you're going to die. Now, Solomon says every man who eats and drinks sees good. Now, of course, that means eating and drinking in moderation, not eating to the point of gluttony and not drinking to the point. That means not eating to the point of gluttony and not drinking to the point of drunkenness. Here's another verse in Ecclesiastes where Solomon says that labor is actually good. Ecclesiastes 2:24, there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen that it is from the hand of God. Well, yeah, labor's good, but it doesn't last. Laborers eventually die. So once again, to repeat, the apparent contradiction in Solomon's attitude towards work, if you look at it for what good it brings in this life, it is good. But if you look at it under the aspect of eternity, it is not good. It is futile. It is vain because you can't take it with you when you go. In verse 14, Solomon says, I know that everything God does will remain forever. And again, that's in contrast with all the different things in the first 8 verses, planting, sowing, reaping, tearing, throwing the stones out, building the walls up with the stones. All of that stuff is change, 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 crying, laughing, dancing, mourning, change, change, change. But now, in contrast to that, we see that everything God does will remain forever in verse 14. So that's what Solomon's trying to do, is contrast the permanence of God with the transitoriness of human life. Now, everything God does will remain. What does God do? Well, everything he does in nature is going to remain. Actually, that's true. The earth is created. It's going to be redeemed. It's going to be around here forever. But also God's decrees, his decisions, what he desires to do, his elect that he saved from before the foundation of the world and all that, that's not going to change. So as a result of that, there is no need to worry about the transitory nature of this life. There's no need to be concerned about striving after the wind. You don't try to catch the wind in this life. It's a waste of time. You work, you labor, it's good, you eat, you drink, and that's fine, but that's only for this life. You don't go any further than that. We go now to Ecclesiastes 3, verse 15. Solomon says, that which is has been already, and that which will be has already been, for God seeks what is passed by. Now, this proverb sounds deep. It's not a proverb. This statement sounds deep. It is a little bit hard to interpret. The first part of the verse is not so hard. That which is has been already. And again, this is talking about God and his eternal attributes. He's again contrasting the permanence of God with the transitory nature of human life. So that which in God has been already, and that is the same as that which is. He hasn't changed, in other words. And then that which will be in the future, God's going to be the same in our future as he is in our past. Of course, God doesn't have a past and a future. God does not change. So that part of the verse is not hard to interpret. But now the last part of the verse, God seeks what is passed by. Now that's the NASB translation. And we do have a translation issue here. So I'm going to give you some different translations. The NIV says, for God will call the past to account, whatever that means. And the NIV marginal note says, God calls back the past. Again, what does that mean? Now we look at the Holman Christian Study Bible translation and we see that God repeats what is past. That's a little strange. The Darby translation says that God bringeth back again that which is past, which is similar to the Holman Christian Study Bible. God's Word translation says, God will call the past to account. Well, what does that mean? The New American Bible says God restores what would otherwise be displaced. What in the world does that mean? Young's literal translation says, God requireth that which is pursued, and that's even more obscure to me. Well, let's go back to the NASB translation. God seeks what is passed by. Let's look at some options as to what this phrase might mean. First option, God's past purposes and decrees are fulfilled. That would go along with the first part of the verse, which says that that which is has been already, and that which will be has already been. And so then if you interpret the last part of the verse, God seeks what is passed by, as saying that God's past purposes and decrees are fulfilled, it fits in with the idea of God's eternity, right? Which is what the first part of the verse is saying. Well, God seeks what is passed by doesn't really reflect that idea of God's past purposes and decrees are fulfilled. However, the Holman Christian Study Bible translation does. God repeats what is past. The Darby translation does. God bringeth back again that which is past. So option one is God is eternal because his past decrees are fulfilled in the future just like they were in the past. Option number two, all of nature shall be as it is in the past. All of nature shall return to its proper order. The same seasons come which have gone before. The same species of animals exist which existed before. The Cambridge commentator says the past is thought of as vanishing, put to flight, receding into the dim distance. It might seem to be passing into the abyss of oblivion, but God recalls it. This is obviously the meaning of require, as used by the translators of the Authorized Version in its strict etymological sense. God brings back the same order, or an analogous order of events, and so history repeats itself. So the idea is God goes back and finds out what's happened in the past, and he does it in the present also. So option number one is God's purposes and decrees are the same in the past as they are now, and option number two is nature is the same in the past as it is now. So the Holman Christian Study Bible translation fits that pretty well. God repeats what has passed. Now there's a third option of how to translate this verse or how to interpret this verse. This is from Ellicott. God is seeking out what happened in the past for the purpose of judgment in the present. So, as John Gill says, we should translate it, God seeks that which is pursued and persecuted. Now, if we look at the next verse, we'll see the context does favor this interpretation. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness. And so, using the context to help us, that would seem that God seeks for the perpetrators of injustice in the past. He seeks for that in order that he might bring justice in the present. Now, God's Word translation favors that. God will call the past to account. The Young's literal translation is God requireth that which is pursued. He requireth means he demands justice from that which is pursued, the criminal, the wrongdoer. Well, just summarizing these options, God seeks what is passed by. The options are he's the same as far as his decrees. He's the same as far as nature, and he is the same as far as his justice is concerned. Whichever one it is, that's what Solomon is getting at. God is permanent. That in God which has been already is now, and that which will be has already been in the past. There's no difference in the past, the present, and the future when you're looking at God, whether you're considering his decrees, his creations in nature, or his justice. We go now to Ecclesiastes 3, verses 16 through 17, Solomon continues, furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. Again, the idea that God's justice is permanent. It might not be justice in this life, but eventually there's going to be perfect justice. Here's an example of how wickedness might have arisen in the place of justice. The Sanhedrin, you know, that same judicial body in ancient Israel that condemned the Son of God to death. Talk about a miscarriage of justice. John Gill says that Solomon had observed a great deal of this kind of injustice in reading the histories of nations. He didn't see the Sanhedrin convict Jesus, but he had seen a lot of injustice. You can't read history without seeing awful lots of injustice. It's just everywhere. It's awful. Solomon had probably seen a lot of injustice in his own courts, in the inferior courts, injustice done by subordinate officers. Now, the guy at the top, Solomon, is not going to be able to rectify all these abuses. He might not have sufficient proof, but he knows it's going on. Even though he was a wise and righteous prince, he's worried about this. I remember President Reagan once said that he went to bed every night knowing that something was happening in that big government of his that he was in charge of. Something was happening that he didn't know about. But Solomon is saying, well, I might not be able to put justice everywhere, but God's going to judge the wicked man as well as the righteous man. He's going to judge everybody. Now, Solomon is resolving a difficulty that he has raised. He has just finished saying that God's providence has given order to all of time and space. That was in that difficult verse 15. God's justice, his decrees, his created nature is the same in the past, the present, and the future. But oops, justice, it's the same. Well, what about all the injustice that Solomon has seen? Well, Solomon gives the answer to that. God will judge the wicked man for a time, for every matter, and for every deed that the wicked man might have committed. God's going to judge that. So he answers his own question. Might not be perfect justice on this earth, but there will be in the next life. Now let's look at this idea of God bringing justice through his judgment. I don't know about you, but one of the things that bothers me so much is when I see the courts not prosecuting injustice, like our CIA and our FBI, just corrupt as it can be, and nothing ever gets done about it. Nobody ever gets nailed. Well, let's see the scriptures that talk about God executing justice. Acts 17:31, because he, that's God, has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man, that's Jesus, whom he, God, has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. When that resurrection happened, that means judgment happened, because the man who was resurrected was going to judge the world in righteousness. 1 Corinthians 4:5, Paul says, therefore do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will bring both to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. And then each man's praise will come to him from God. In other words, don't go around trying to judge. You are weak. You don't have all the facts. You make mistakes. Just put up with some stuff. God's going to take care of it. He's going to judge it. 2 Corinthians 5:10, Paul says, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. Now, I know there's some theology here, but I think that's the white, great white throne judgment, the final judgment. It's called the great white throne judgment of God in Revelation. Here it's the judgment seat of Christ. I think it's the same thing. And there's going to be judgment done there, either rewards or punishment. Ecclesiastes 12:14, for God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. We can't function in this life without judgment. We can't even live on the planet without killing each other and destroying each other without judgment being done on criminals. It's not perfect judgment, but there is enough to keep civilization going. You have to have judgment. And folks, that's why you have to have hell. Where are you going to put Pol Pot and Xi Jinping and Mao Zedong and all the terrorists that have befouled human history? Where are you going to put them if there's no hell? How is there going to be justice? How is there going to be judgment? Matthew 12:36-37. Jesus says, but I tell you that every careless word that people speak, they shall give an accounting for it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. We will be judged. Now, fortunately for Christians, our judgment will be covered by the blood of Jesus, because if we didn't have that, we would all be condemned to everlasting hell. Jude 1:14-15. It was also about these men, talking about these evil people messing up the Christians. It was also about these men that Enoch and the seventh generation from Adam prophesied, saying, behold, the Lord came with many thousands of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all, and to convict all the ungodly of all their ungodly deeds which they have done in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. There's going to be judgment. I emphasize that because today's wussy-pussy evangelical church won't even mention the word judgment. That's not loving. We believe in love. Love wins. There's no hell. Rob Bell said so. We go to Ecclesiastes 3:18-21. Solomon continues, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, They all have the same breath, and there's no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast ascends downward to the earth? Solomon says in verse 18, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, who are the sons of men? Well, it could be just men in general, and I think that's what it is. Adam Clark suggests it might be in particular the crooked judges that were aforementioned, these same judges who did not bring forth justice on the earth. In verse 16, Solomon says, in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. Oh, the judges aren't doing their duty, and these are the people that Solomon compares to beasts, according to Adam Clark. Well, maybe so, but I would think that the term beast applies to everybody. Let's look at some scriptures that say the same thing. This is Psalms 32, verse 9, written by David. Do not be as the horse or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose trappings include bit and bridle to hold them in check. Otherwise, they will not come near to you. In other words, people can act like horses or like mules. And in fact, sometimes people act like the rear end of a horse, if you know what I mean. Now here's a psalm written by the sons of Korah, Psalms 49, verse 12. But man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beast that perish. All animals die and all men die. That's what makes them like beasts. Psalm 49, verse 20. 8 verses later in this psalm by the sons of Korah, man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beast that perish, as that psalm repeats the same idea. Now, the point of comparison between men and beasts is only with regards to the certainty of death. Men and animals are obviously different with regards to a final judgment. Man is made in the image of God. He is held accountable. Animals are not. You're not going to find animals at the great white throne judgment of God, at the judgment seat of Christ. They're not going to be there. Now let's look at verse 17 of Ecclesiastes 3, and we will see that God judges men. God will judge the righteous and the wicked. But if we drop down to verse 21 in this chapter of Ecclesiastes 3, we see Solomon say, who knows if the spirit of people rise upward and the spirit of animals goes downward to the earth? Now, that's not a direct statement that that's what happens, but we know that's what happens. The spirit of people rises upward to heaven, the spirit of animals goes downward to the earth and dies. There's no judgment for animals. So the point when Solomon is saying that men are like beasts is not that we have the same accountability as beasts or we have the same moral workings as a beast, like the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. They say that we should be able to bring animals to court or animals should bring people to court. This absurd mixing of animals and humans that these perverts in our modern culture do, that's not what's being talked about here. It's that beasts die and people die, and that's why everything is vanity. Looking at Ecclesiastes as a whole, you will see that when Solomon talks about everything is vanity and striving after the wind, it's futile, it's meaningless. The reason that that is so is because people die. That's what he's talking about, is death. He's got no problem with what happens on this life is when people die. It all goes away. Beasts die just like men, as we see in verse 19. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. That's the point of comparison, is the death. When there's a calamity, beasts die just like men do. Men die just like beasts do. The plagues of Egypt, remember the cattle and all in Egypt died too. Noah's flood, all the animals died there as well as people. Now in verse 21, Solomon says, who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward? Who knows? That's a rhetorical question. The idea is nobody knows. And what that means is nobody with his natural reasoning ability knows. As John Gill says, quote, by the dint of reason, by the strength of his own understanding, without a divine revelation, that man has an immortal soul which goes upwards at death, when that of a beast goes downwards. Who knows? Obviously, I can't look at somebody or something dying and watch their spirit, see which direction it goes, because the spirit is not naturally discerned. Now, some people have said this proves that Solomon believed that the spirit of man, the breath of man, ascended upward. Some people say that Solomon is denying that. Well, no, neither one. He's just skeptical about it. He's saying, you can't see, you can't tell. As the Cambridge commentator says, the words imply a strictly skeptical rather than a negative answer. They do not actually deny, still less do they affirm, as some have thought, that the spirit of man does ascend to a higher life, while that of a brute returns to dust. Solomon is saying, you can't tell, you don't know. Now, some have said that Solomon is affirming the afterlife. They are saying that not only does Solomon not doubt the afterlife, but rather that he affirms it. No, I don't think so. Now, that skepticism affirms Solomon's pessimism. He's saying, everything is vain on the earth, and, well, maybe we can go up to heaven and live an extra life, but who knows? You can't tell it. You can't see it. So he is pessimistic here. But when we get to the end of the book in Ecclesiastes 12:7, we read this, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. And there you have proof that Solomon believed in the afterlife with God. People often ask, well, do people in the Old Testament know about the afterlife? Well, how about right here, Ecclesiastes 12:7, the spirit will return to God who gave it. How about Job? I know that my Redeemer liveth, and I will see him on the circle of the earth. I forgot how that phrase goes, but that verse might not be able to prove the resurrection of the body because of a translation issue, but that verse in Job does say that there will be an afterlife. How about in the law when Moses encountered God in the burning bush near Mount Sinai, and God says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who presumably were still living in the afterlife. So, yes, there was a belief in the afterlife in the Old Testament. Solomon does not affirm that here in verse 21. I agree that he does not do that, although some people say so, but I don't think so. And one last note here in verse 21, who knows that the breath of man ascends? That breath is ruach in the Hebrew, which is spirit, can be translated as spirit as well as breath, same thing. It's kind of like pneuma in the Greek, which can mean wind, or it can mean breath, it can mean spirit. In verse 21, ruach is used both of the spirit of the man and the spirit of the animal, or the soul of the animal, the soul of man. Same word, but different destination. The soul of man ascends into heaven, the ruach of man goes up, and the ruach of the animal goes down into the dust. We go now to the last verse in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 22. Solomon says, I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? In other words, you better be happy in this life because you can't see what's happening afterwards. And of course, it's impossible to be happy in this life without knowing what comes afterwards. But Solomon is saying that, hey, you better be happy because if you don't consider the afterlife, you don't know what's coming. Now, of course, I don't think, well, we know that Solomon knows that man cannot be happy in his activities in this life, except on a temporary basis. Here's what Adam Clark says about being happy in your activities. Quote, do not turn God's blessings into sin by perverseness and complaining. Make the best of life. God will sweeten its bitters to you if you be faithful. Remember, this is the state to prepare for glory, and the evils of life may be so sanctified to you as to work for your good. Though even wretched without, you may be happy within, for God can make all grace to abound towards you. You may be happy if you please. Cry to God, who never rejects the prayer of the humble, and gives his Holy Spirit to all them that ask him. And that's some good advice, folks. All of our earthly life is a probationary period for preparing us to enter into eternal life. You have that attitude, you're going to be a happy man or a happy woman. That's going to make you happy. So when Solomon says in verse 22 that man should be happy in his activities, that means considering life under the sun, as he puts it, in this life. But he's not going to be happy when considering life sub specie aeternitatis, considered from the aspect of eternity. If man's activities were his main portion, they would be vanity and striving for wind. So the value of work must be kept in its proper place. It should not be valued too highly or too lowly. It's good, but only temporarily good, only penultimately good. Now, the last part of verse 22 says, for who will bring this man to see what will occur after him? In other words, once he dies, looking at it from the point of view of life on this earth, once you die, you can't see what you've done and it's over. Now, of course, if you looked at it from the point of eternity, you will be able to see what you've done. But Solomon is talking about here from the aspect of living in this life. Nobody's going to show a dead man what he did here in this life because he's dead. He's in the grave. He can't see naturally. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we are prepared in our next audio to go to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, which I will call oppression, toil, friendlessness, advancement is meaningless. I hope you stay tuned for that encouraging chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this one.